Hello and welcome to Marshall Matters with me, Winston Marshall, at the Spectator offices in London. Today I'm joined by Rahima Mahmood. Rahima is the UK director of the Uyghur Congress. She is the co-founder and executive director of the Stop Uyghur Genocide organization, as well as being a beautiful singer, activist, translator, author, writer, and someone I consider to be the embodiment of Uyghur culture and one of the great spokespersons for the Uyghurs here in Europe and in the UK. Rahima, thank you so much for making the time to speak with me.
Thank you for that very kind introduction and thank you for having me.
Of course. So on the 24th of May, Adrian Zenz has released what has been called the Xinjiang Police Files. Now we'll get into that, but before speaking about that, I was wondering if you could maybe explain to listeners or watchers who don't know who the Uyghurs are. Who are the Uyghurs?
Well, Uyghurs are the Turkic-speaking people. We share more cultural similar culture and the language with Turkic people. The closest cousins are the Uzbeks. I often say that culturally we are far more closer to Istanbul than Beijing. So our language is Turkic. We believe in Islam. And we have our own very distinct, unique culture, music, and Islamic tradition, and so on. So it's we are very different from the majority Han Chinese people.
In fact, there's no Chinese ethnicity that's part of the Uyghur makeup. It's a separate ethnicity as well as having a whole other tradition altogether.
Yes, that's exactly, I think, the problem here. We are very different. Geographically, we always lived in the nowadays what China called Xinjiang, but we prefer to call it East Turkestan. So it's a land of Turkic people. Mm. So we are geographically in the eastern side of Turkestan. So you can compare the Turkic people and the Chinese people, or you can compare a Turkish person to a Chinese. That is exactly the difference we have with the Chinese people.
I see. So actually, I think it was in Mao annexed Xinjiang.
The region was occupied during the Qing dynasty. Mm-hmm. But then we had two very brief independence. East Turkestan Republic in 1933, very short-lived, then 1944. The communist invasion, or rather, is a collaborative effort between the Soviet Union and Mao's China at that time, the Chinese Communist Party. Soon after they declared the Chinese Communist Party being the ruler of China, and the so-called Xinjiang was annexed. So Xinjiang means new territory or new frontier. Although Chinese government often say that Xinjiang has been the inseparable part of China from historical time. As it goes back to 2,000-3,000 years. But the truth is, it was called Xinjiang only after during the Qing dynasty. It was occupied military occupation. And they renamed the region called Xinjiang. The name itself, it means it is a very new territory that was colonized by China.
What's the significance for the Uyghurs and about this report from Adrian Zenz?
Well, since the Chinese communist government occupation in 1949, disaster never stopped, one massacre after another. Since the rightist movement started in 1958, then Cultural Revolution, brief freedom we had in the 80s, then from early 90s, again the crackdown, one crackdown after another. So we suffered a discrimination and a crackdowns over decades. But I have never expected the situation become this one of horror.
Mm.
So for Uyghurs, life became one of horror since 2016, after Chen Quanguo, the party secretary who ruled Tibet for 5 years, terrorizing Tibetans. Then he was appointed to party secretary in August 2016. And they were already developing to completely transform the East Turkestan into one of the biggest police state. So experimenting their latest technology, high-tech surveillance and genocidal policies. So Adrian Zenz's report, it just reconfirmed what has been happening. And I know those photos were taken during 2017 and 2018. That was a period when the mass arrests started. And you can see from the photos the terrified people, young and old.
Hmm.
I mean, since I saw the report and looking through those photos, it's difficult to hold back my tears.
Hmm.
And especially I lost contact with my entire family, my relatives, my friends, since early 2017. And the last time I spoke to my brother, my eldest brother, was on the 3rd of January 2017. After 2 months, I couldn't get hold of anyone. And when I asked him after he picked up the phone, I said, "When no one is answering my phone call," he said, "They did the right thing. Please leave us in God's hands. We leave you in God's hand too." And that's my last conversation. The conversation lasted only like 2 minutes after he picked up that phone. And I'm not the only one. Majority of Uyghurs, regardless they are activists or not, they received very similar messages from their parents, from their siblings, said, "Please don't call us. We will reach out to you when things get better."
Mm-hmm.
And having experienced a lot of crackdown, even when I was there, I left my country in 2000. There will normally a period of like 1 month, 2 months, sometimes 3 months, the crackdown, and then it get back to normal. And I didn't think this would last this long. It's 5.5 years. Since I spoke to my brother, and since I came to this country in September 2000 and never went back, because I decided to speak up and to tell the story about my people and the invasion, also this massacres, especially the Gulja massacre, that I was in Gulja, in my hometown, in February 1997.
Mm.
And that is the event which I decided to leave.
So you said earlier the things were escalating through the 90s after a period of peace in the 80s. And then what's this event in 1997?
From the end of 1996, religious crackdown started in Gulja. So police raided mosques and people's homes after tip-off to arrest mainly young religious clerics.
Mm.
And just like all Islamic community, Muslim community, anyone who has good knowledge in Islam, they become kind of center of the community. So after the Cultural Revolution, after the religion was banned, up until Mao died in 1976, Then from 1978, the new leadership declared that religious freedom will be restored because that is under the Chinese constitution. So there was a revival of religion, culture, everything. So during 80s, we did have really great like novels. Historians wrote historical novels, and also revival of religion. A lot of Uyghurs went abroad to study religion, because for that 20-30 years period, it was banned. So basically, you didn't have the Uyghurs didn't have the opportunity to learn to study religion. Unlike my family, because my father was very religious, so he taught very kind of secretly, but most of the families didn't have that kind of opportunities. So in early 90s, the Chinese government suddenly realized or suddenly decided that, you know, having this kind of revival of religion and culture is a threat to their power. So the crackdown started from early 90s. Then 1997 was a kind of really, I can say this was one of the biggest massacre that happened in the history of Gholja city, Gholja, where I come from. So after 2 months of crackdown, hundreds of religious clerics and mostly very successful businessmen, many of these religious scholars or clerics, they are quite successful in their own career as well, or either they are business people or have different kind of a career which people look up to. So they obviously attract the crowd. So anyone who could attract the crowd, who could gather more people, that was considered to be the, you know, organizer of illegal gatherings or illegal Islamic activities. So after hundreds of these young clerics were arrested, Uyghur youth decided to protest against this arbitrary detention. So on the 5th of February 1997, Uyghur, mainly young male from various different villages and towns, came to Gholja city. The initial figure, it was about, initial number was about 200. And then other Uyghurs joined who didn't plan or anything. After seeing the slogans, it said, religion is not a crime. Practicing religion is not a crime. Practicing mashrab is not a crime. It's another cultural, century-old cultural tradition was also banned at that time. So practicing or mashrab gathering is not a crime. Release our religious leaders. And then this protest, the number of people became thousands, including some school children also joined. People, after closing their shop, they joined as well. Initially, the police allowed the march. They didn't do anything, but we know later they had already know this is going to happen. They prepared, well prepared. So after they came to the town hall, to all the Uyghurs assembled at this one place, they deployed the military from neighboring county called Buyandai and encircled the protesters and opened fire. We believe over 100 died, and then followed by mass arrest, 4,000 to 5,000. In fact, the real number of, you know, the protesters, not even that many, but they wrongfully arrested a lot of youth. Some streets, you hardly can see any young male left. And that was the Gholja massacre. It was a turning point, and is one of the really kind of horrible scene that I have seen since the Tiananmen massacre. It was just terrorizing. Police raided houses, coming at night to search if there anyone who looked like the person in the photos they had. And then later, after I came here in 2000, then the 2009 July 5th massacre happened in Urumqi. And from the YouTube videos and other eyewitness accounts, I could relate that to the Hoxha massacre. It was very, very similar.
So there's a couple of significant bits. I want to ask you about how you left, because actually that must be quite a story, seeing as I imagine it's near impossible now to leave the area. But the significance of this 1997 date is that the CCP narrative is that they are reacting to what they consider Islamic extremism. In fact, they for a while denied that there were any camps, and that slowly changed, and now they're saying they're reacting to Islamic extremism, and they'll cite that there's 4,000 to 5,000 Uyghurs who signed up for ISIS, that there are, I'll get the pronunciation wrong, Urumqi was in 2009, they will say that around 200 Han Chinese were killed. They'll say in 2013, a Uyghur family drove a car into Tiananmen Square, killing two. And then what is supposedly the Chinese 9/11 was in 2014, there was the railway attack at the station where 31 were killed by Uyghur extremists. And so in what context should I understand the extremist side of the...
You know, so when you just mentioned about ISIS, for example, we know there are a number of Uyghurs joined them, but it's extremely difficult to explain how these people ended up, you know, all the way from some villages than in Turkey or in Syria,
yeah,
when you cannot travel from village to village freely.
Yeah. So what is how would they have got there?
It's trafficking, human trafficking. It's because when you are in a kind of really desperate situation, like how women ended up being, you know, trafficked for sex or other things, not knowingly. This is exactly how it happened to Uyghur people. When you feel, when you are in danger, when you know that you cannot practice religion, you are at risk of being arrested and put in camps or in prison, you seek opportunity to leave the country. And that there are people out there also trying to use this situation against them to make money. Mm-hmm. So many people sold their houses, all the savings, and paying the these traffickers, the human traffickers, and then they ended up in wrong places, not knowingly. So this is a kind of situation. And also about the Urumqi 2009, we call it massacre, they say unrest. The protests started also very peaceful, led by the Xinjiang University students after some videos appeared in on Youku, similar like YouTube, that the Chinese people killing two Uyghur factory workers in Shaoguan City in Guangdong province. That was really kind of brutal when you watch the way how they killed them and then they posted on Youku. So university students first petitioned that provincial government to hold those who killed these two factory workers accountable, but they didn't receive any reply. Then on the 5th of July, so the Uyghurs, led by the university students, then many others who were very angry about what happened after seeing this video footage. It was also very peaceful protest. Demanded the government to answer the question about how they're going to deal with these killings and whether those Chinese who killed these Uyghurs will be tried, held accountable. Instead of meeting the protesters, the leaders, again, they deployed military and police, open fire. Many died. So the Chinese version of 200 died, it's their version of reporting. They never report how many people they killed. So because of this peaceful protest turned into riot, it's not because the Uyghurs wanted this to be a riot. Because this really unfair treatment against the peaceful protesters then led some Uyghurs just so outraged after seeing this mass arrest, dragging Uyghurs onto trucks, and they disappeared, all this. We know since 2009 that July 5th protests happened, thousands missing. Up until now, we don't know what happened to those people. And a very small minority of Uyghurs, and they just decided to revenge. And that's how it happened. The Chinese version of they show you the how they turned over buses and the killing others. But you cannot see any footage of how they opened fire, killing peaceful protesters and arresting thousands, and in like going into Uyghur neighborhood, you just indiscriminately arrest and taken away many people. This arrest lasted up until September 2009. And so it was also a turning point. So after this, the Chinese version of that the Uyghur killed 200, majority were Chinese, they implemented the extrajudicial killing and extrajudicial arrest policy. So police had power to kill or arrest anyone they believe they are suspicious or they show some kind of threat. And so it was the extreme turning point. Also, it feels like this was a kind of pre-planned, because we know the historical, from the history, all these events. In order to completely like crack down or make a decision to kill or to arrest, there has to be some kind of excuses. So this was a very good excuse for the Chinese government that say that Uyghurs are potential terrorists. Look, they are against the Chinese settlers in the region. Using their propaganda, instilling this hatred, also the Chinese people, and the relationship between the Uyghurs and the Chinese also became very, very intense. And therefore, when you see now, after millions of Uyghurs interned, you don't really hear a lot from the wider Chinese population condemning their governments, because through over so many years, they have kind of brainwashed their own citizen, portraying Uyghurs as backwards, as thieves, as terrorists. And so the majority Chinese people thinks that Uyghurs deserve this.
So actually, it's incorrect to even understand these terrorist or extremist events as Islamic terrorist extremist events. No, they're, firstly, we don't know the whole story. As you say, the Chinese, the CCP are only revealing a certain amount of the information, so we don't have a real picture of what happened. But also, these would be, if they are an extremist fringe, it's the extremist fringe of a desperate people rather than Muslim extremists, rather than it's not a religious movement.
I believe so, because I know from the time I, 1997, after that Khulja massacre, that event, we know they just cracking down on any like peaceful religious clerics and activities. It is extremely difficult for me to imagine that is a space can have any kind of extremism to grow and to develop when you are under in such kind of watchful eyes all the time. Rather, it's because of this kind of unfair treatment and having had families served in prison or disabled or being killed, massacred, and all these really kind of implanted hatred. And so sometimes when you are really, really, really angry, the things can happen. Just like, you know, when you compare all this to, you know, the US, how people, you know, just massacre people, you don't call them terrorists. You know, sometimes you relate them to having some kind of psychological problem. And I believe my people might have developed those psychological problems as well. Imagine when you don't have anywhere to complain, to have any kind of support, comfort, and the state is the biggest power against you. And, you know, and also all these events, none of them were independently verified. It's just the Chinese version of the events that very conveniently to link the Uyghur population to this kind of terrorism.
So in 1997, you decided to leave. And I think in Britain today, I think there's about 400 Uyghurs in the diaspora. So not many people have left or have been able to leave. How is it that you... Would it be fair to say you fled or you escaped? Or was it... That must... I'm assuming that was a staggering journey.
Well, at that time, I didn't have any other kind of record, like criminal record or any record of being an activist or whatever, even though I attended a protest during the 1989 Students' Democratic Movement in Beijing. But because of the sheer number of people attended that, they couldn't kind of have record of everyone. So I was quite lucky I didn't have that record in my file. And also, as being a teacher at the college, although I have been quite active in kind of promoting the rights, but in a way that was very, very discreet. It wasn't like I wasn't the like target at the time. So I managed to apply for passport. What I said was I want to do master's degree and come back to serve the college better. And I just said I felt that I need to gain more knowledge in the field of chemistry, and because I was teaching chemistry and English at the college. And then they agreed, the university agreed. Then it took me about a year to apply for visa. And so luckily, yeah, my visa was successful in, my application for visa was successful in August 2000. And I traveled in September.
So where you traveled from Xinjiang, presumably?
Yeah, I traveled from Urumqi, from my home, from the place where I worked, Maitag, by train to Urumqi, then from Urumqi to Beijing, 48 hours journey, I think. Then from Beijing to
driving
to Manchester.
In a car?
On
train?
Train, yeah. Yes. Train journey. Then from Beijing to Manchester via Istanbul.
Wow.
So I traveled alone. I know there is no way I can get visa for my family. Then 2 years later, luckily, my son and his father, my ex-husband, they successfully obtained the visa to visit me.
So you went to Manchester, university in Manchester?
No, a University of Central Lancashire.
Okay.
So when I landed in Manchester.
So you're doing a master's in chemistry?
No, a master's in environmental management. So this is also related to chemistry, environmental waste management. So they required a degree in chemistry related courses. So because my background is petrochemical engineering, and that's why I was accepted to do that degree.
But you didn't have intention of going back?
No.
No.
That was a kind of, that was the only way available that for me to leave. That was the only kind of, not easy, but there's not any other option, especially at that time. I didn't know any illegal routes, or you could pay and can travel illegally out of the country. But still, I believe God had the plan for me, and I managed.
And how did your son and ex-husband then arrive?
I left my son when he was 5. We reunited when he was 7. Oh. And it's hard. It was hard. So whenever I speak to these women, a lot of them in Turkey, who cut off from their children, they left behind some 3-4 children since 2007. I feel very, very sad. I cannot imagine a mother, you know, 3-4 young children taken away by the state and not allowing you to know where they are, what
the
happened
to them.
The
state taking them away?
Yeah.
I hadn't...
Yeah, children, separation of children. Anyone who... So what happened was, after the parents or one of the parents taken away to camps, they also took the children away to children's camps. Chinese government say that it's a boarding school, they're providing the best education, but it's a kind of children's transformation school, so that these children grow up completely isolated from their own culture, the language, and the religion. Mm. So we know from the kind of rough estimate, 500,000, but we believe the figure be very, very high. Because if you have 1 million or up to 3 million people, and these their children, they left behind, initially they were allowed to have other family members to look after them, and then later they were all sent to these centers, and they are not allowed to go out from school without permission. So it's almost like children's internment camps as well.
Wow.
So you can see that from the photos, you know, that was leaked, there are children as well.
Really?
There's one young girl, she looked maybe about 10, 11, had this pink t-shirt, and the jacket is obviously it's adult, someone else's jacket, is like adult's jacket.
Mm.
And you can see that the hair was shaved. And just one of the photos, it really upset me.
Mm. I remember the first I'd come across heard of what was going on in Xinjiang was the photo, it was the drone footage in 2018 of the shaven heads of these prisoners with black blindfolds on, sat with their arms behind their folded behind their backs and cross-legged outside a train station, and you see that, and immediately, as a European, you immediately think of the death camps of the 1940s, and in fact, it is the largest internment of an ethnic group in the world since then. But there is surprisingly little footage. There's a lot of testimonies, and I've heard some of them, even at the Uyghur Tribunal, which was in November, December 2021 last year. There were some very moving testimonies of what's going on. There's accusations of rape, of organ harvesting. It's completely devastating. But what the information that's coming through, considering the scale on which it's purported to be going on, is quite small. And I suppose that's why the Zen's report that's been released is really more evidence of the grand scale of things.
Yeah, these kind of horrors, especially when it is happening behind the closed doors, it's more horrible, more scary. Why the Chinese government ban Uyghurs speak to their family abroad? Why would my brother tell me, leave us in God's hands, when they often worried about my health, because I survived cancer in 2013, and I kept very close contact with everyone, because they always worried, you know, whether cancer would come back, whether I will fall ill again, and then just completely cut off. If the consequence is not that severe, they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't really cut off from me. So you can imagine, you know, this, what is happening behind this completely blocked from the view, the places. Just like the Holocaust, you didn't know until it was liberated. And we will know only the truth if the CCP regime fell. Only when there is an independent, completely different government or organizations can really go there, have this unfettered access to record what has happened.
We haven't even got to speak about your art and your singing. I had the great pleasure of seeing you perform at St. Bartholomew the Great's in November in London, and it was an evening of Uyghur music, food, art, and you performed some traditional songs and some newer songs. Were you brought up singing? Were these songs part of your upbringing, or is this something that you've appreciated now being away from your home?
You can see my face changes. Whenever we talk about art, music, or poetry, you know, I completely kind of shift from this very sad, the human rights situation, genocide, and whatever. I'm in a completely different planet, in a different world. So, music is, for me, it's an escape from this really horrible situation. Always been. I was very, very lucky, born into a family of musicians. So my mother's side, from my great-grandfathers, they were quite known musicians in Golja. And so from the time that I remember was my mother's beautiful singing, from lullaby to the other folk songs. And my mom had very beautiful voice, and she played dutar as well.
What's a dutar? And a
dutar is a two-string. Du is two, and tar is a Persian.
Oh, a dutar.
So tar, yeah, dutar, okay. Is two tar. So they're kind of simple instrument that a lot, like women play a lot. And for Uyghur people, when you, I don't know now, but when the time I grow up, whenever you go to anyone's home, you have like a dutar hang on the wall.
Okay.
Just even if they didn't know how to play, it's just like if you have a musician come to the house, at least you have the dutar that you can offer them to play. At my family home, we had dutar, tambur, and the violin.
What's a tambur?
Tambur is another string instrument. It's far more complicated, a bit like a saz and. Tambur is like one of the most important instruments for the Golja folk songs. So you see tambur a lot in Golja, where I come from, and rubab the one that play. Like this is a, it's a similar string instrument, but sounds slightly different.
A rhubarb sounds like a banjo.
Rhubarb is is common in the southern part of East Turkestan.
Okay.
And the tambur is very common in the northern part of East Turkestan because the folk songs, the ranges are very different. Like a Scottish folk song and when you hear the Irish folk song, very different.
Of course.
So the Golja folk song, Kashgar folk songs, Kucha folk song, Turpan, very, very different. It has a very, its own different style. Although all, you know, Uyghur, but very different style. So I always say that I was very lucky person to be born in this very large, also religious. My father was a very religious, and he read, you know, his recitation of Quran was something that I cannot compare anywhere. Maybe because he, you know, as a child, the first time I heard from him, so all often woke up in the morning from his recitation of Quran.
Would it be a song?
Yeah, Quran. You know that I don't know if you ever listened to like imams or the qaris recite Quran is very much like a song. It's absolutely beautiful. Uh-huh. And the recitation of Quran. Then during the day, listening my mother while doing housework, just quietly singing. And then whenever we had any family gatherings, or even like if my uncle's family came to visit my mom, my family, and both my two uncles, they were really great musicians and singers. There will be like 3-4 people. One would be playing dutar, another playing tambur, and another playing violin, and then they would be singing. So like in summer, they would like play under the vine. Then we will have like neighbors would just sit on the wall. And then my mom would say, just come in, you know, you don't have to sit over there, you can come. And then it just become like a big party. So I grew up in that kind of environment. We lived in the village until I was 10. So there was a beautiful village life. We had a very big house, apple orchards, and a lot of this kind of musical, spontaneous kind of musical events happened at home or in orchards or in this kind of open spaces. I grew up just following them, following my brothers and singing. And I remember when I was little, my brother's friends, when they passed the street, they often came and said, Rahima, please sing us a song. And I'd say no, and then they would say, "I'm gonna give you a sweet," you know, kind of bribe me, and I would just stand there and sing, and I would try to get the sweet.
Well, we now have video of one of the songs from Saint Bartholomew the Great. It's a song called Tarim. Now, Tarim, or the Tarim Network, is the name of your son Zaf's organization, and Zaf's become a friend of mine. And actually, I was just reminded before this interview that Zaf and I went to a comedy show in London by our engineer Sam Holmes here, and it was the Angel Comedy Club, I think. He's a very courageous guy, because at one point in the set, Sam called out to the crowd. He said, "Are there any right wingers here?" And your son Zaf put his hand up and went, "Uri," and he was the only one in the room. Now, to admit, to admit being conservative or right wing in comedy circles is borderline suicidal. So he showed real courage there, and he's certainly a man who doesn't give a, you know, he doesn't care. He's very impressive guy, and he has this charity, Tarim Network, which supports promoting or keeping Uyghur culture alive for the youth. So I encourage listeners to go check them out. But maybe you can tell us about this song, Tarim, that we're about to listen to.
Okay, thank you. Tarim, we have Tarim Basin in the south and the Tarim River. So Tarim, the river, we always call it, is a cradle of the Uyghur civilization. So it's a very important part of the Uyghur land, the East Turkestan. Tarim also associates with the one of the most notorious labor camps that was set up during the Cultural Revolution. It still exists, still have prisoners there, and all the forced labor, picking cotton, and this is still ongoing. So the song Tarim was written during the Cultural Revolution when people were arrested, just like now, were arrested in masses and taken to Tarim labor camp. So the song says that I am going to Tarim and a farewell to all my loved ones, all that we grow up together. And if you come to Tarim, I will embroider you with flowers. Tarim is a desert. The Tarim labor camp where they are, you know, these Uyghurs were taken at that time. It's not the place where you can have flowers, but it's a kind of symbolic. It's a way to, in a metaphor, to stay positive. So even in a desert, even if I am in the camp, in the labor camps, I will still make sure if you visit me, and I will embroider you with flowers. And when you listen to the song, you feel like sometimes you want to cry, because it really shows that emotion, that pain. And also is a song that is really suitable to sing in this kind of open field. So when I sing Tarim, strangely, when I close my eyes, I see those cotton fields, like you cannot see the end, and the desert, and then these prisoners.
Rahima Mahmoud, thank you so much for your time and for sharing. It's just been very moving and fascinating. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, Yay!